The Life of Alexander Henderson by Thomas McCree. Those transactions which have rendered the middle of the 17th century so famous in the history of Britain aroused and drew forth to public view men of the most eminent talents in the northern as well as the southern part of our island. Scotland could at that time boast of her patriots both in church and state, inferior to those of no other nation, of statesmen, able, disinterested, enlightened, jealous of the rights of their country, and at the same time loyal to their prince, of ministers of religion, distinguished for learning and piety, and who counted nothing dear to them, provided that they might advance the kingdom of Christ and secure their religious privileges. To that band of illustrious reformers who stood firm against the encroachments of tyranny and superstition, we owe under God whatever we enjoy most valuable in religion and liberty, although justice is seldom done to their character and actings in the histories of that period, and their memories have often been loaded with the most odious charges and libelous abuse. Among these, the subject of the following memoir held a conspicuous place, and the stations to which he was called, and the important services which he performed, give a high interest to his character and to the particulars of his life. Alexander Henderson was born about the year 1583. Of his parents, or the circumstances of the early part of his life, no authentic information has descended to us. Being intended for the service of the church, he was sent to the University of St. Andrews to complete his education about the commencement of the 17th century. His abilities and application soon distinguished him in literary improvement, and after having finished the usual course of studies and passed his degrees with applause, he was chosen teacher of a class of philosophy and rhetoric in that university. The Church of Scotland had at this period suffered a great change. The liberty of her assemblies was infringed. Episcopacy, with its attendant evils, obtruded upon her, and to make way for these innovations, her most able and faithful ministers were banished, imprisoned, silenced, or driven into obscure and distant corners. Particular care was taken to poison the sources of learning by placing the tuition of youth under the care of time-serving and corrupt men. The learned and intrepid Andrew Melville, who had presided over the College of St. Andrews with great success and renown, was removed, detained, and at last finally excluded from his station under the most deceitful pretexts, and persons placed in his room, and that of his colleagues, who were fit instruments for disseminating such principles as were favorable to the corrupt measures then carrying on. Mr. Henderson, being then a young man and ambitious of preferment, became a warm advocate for the new measures. Though the authority is not the best, yet there is reason to think that what Bishop Guthrie says of him is not without foundation, that, quote, being professor of philosophy in St. Andrews, he did, at the laureation of his class, choose Archbishop Gladstanes for his patron, with a very flattering dedication for which he had the Kirk of Lucres given him shortly after. Unquote. This may assist us in determining the time at which Mr. Henderson entered into the ministry. As he received the parish through the patronage of Archbishop Gladstanes, and as that prelate died in 1615, he must have entered on or before that year. His settlement at Lucres, procured in the manner above mentioned, was unpopular to such a degree that on the day of his ordination the people secured the church doors, and the ministers who attended, together with the presentee, were obliged to break in by the window. When a sober people discover such violent symptoms of dissatisfaction with a minister, there is reason to conclude that there is something wrong either with the candidate or the manner of his introduction among them. In the present instance, there were both. For the person who was appointed to take the oversight of them not only was known to be a defender of those corruptions to which the great body of the people in Scotland were averse, but discovered little or no regard to the spiritual interests of the flock upon whom he had been obtruded. A most unhappy connection, which it is probable would only have continued until his interest had procured him a change to a better living, had not every ground of dissatisfaction between him and his people been removed, and a foundation of lasting comfort between them laid in the merciful ordination of God. Mr. Henderson had not continued long in Lucre's when an important change was effected on the state of his mind, a change which had an influence upon the whole of his future conduct. About this time, that truly great man, Mr. Robert Bruce, who had been banished from Edinburgh for refusing to comply with a mandate from the court respecting the Gowrie conspiracy, and was driven from one part of the country to another, through the fears entertained from his opposition to the measures of the court and bishops, had obtained liberty to return from Inverness, the place of his restraint. This interval of freedom he improved by preaching at different places to which he had access, and was followed by crowds whom his piety, his talents, and his sufferings drew together to hear him, particularly on fast days and at communions. Hearing of a communion in the neighborhood at which Mr. Bruce was expected to assist, Mr. Henderson, attracted by his fame or from some other motive, went thither secretly and placed himself in a dark corner of the church where he would remain most concealed. Mr. Bruce came into the pulpit, and after a pause, according to his usual manner, which fixed Mr. Henderson's attention on him, he read, and with his accustomed emphasis and deliberation, these words as his text: "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber." Words so descriptive of the character of an intruder, and so literally applicable to the manner in which he entered upon his ministry at Lucre's, went like drawn swords to the heart of Mr. Henderson. He who wished to conceal himself from all felt that he was naked and opened to the word of God. The secrets of his heart were made manifest, his conscience convicted, and yielding to the force of divine truth, he worshipped God, and going away reported that God was of a truth in those whose ways were so opposite to his own. In one word, the discourse of that powerful preacher on this occasion was, by the divine blessing, the means of Mr. Henderson's conversion. Ever after, he retained a great affection for his spiritual father, Mr. Bruce, and used to make mention of him with marks of the highest respect. We need not doubt that Mr. Henderson's change of mind would soon discover itself in his conduct, and that he would strive by all means in his power to promote the edification of the people of his charge, and to remove the offense which he had caused by the manner of his first entrance among them. Let us hear himself speaking on this subject in his address to his brethren in the famous assembly at Glasgow, more than 20 years after the period of which we now speak. Quote, "There are divers among us that have had no such warrant for our entry to the ministry as were to be wished. Alas, how many of us have rather sought the kirk than the kirk sought us! How many have rather gotten the kirk given to them than they have been given to the kirk for the good thereof! And yet there must be a great difference put between these that have lived many years in an unlawful office, without warrant of God, and therefore must be abominable in the sight of God, and those who in some respects have entered unlawfully, and with an ill conscience, and afterwards have come to see the evil of this, and to do what in them lies to repair the injury. The one is like a marriage altogether unlawful and null in itself. The other is like a marriage in some respects unlawful and inexpedient, but that may be mended by the diligence and fidelity of the parties in doing their duty afterwards. So should it be with us who entered lately into the calling of the ministry. If there were any faults or wrong steps in our entry, and who of us are free, acknowledge the Lord's calling of us, if we have since got a seal from heaven of our ministry, and let us labor with diligence and faithfulness in our office." Unquote. A concern about personal religion and the salvation of the souls of men has often led to a concern about the prerogatives of the King of Zion as connected with the external government of his church. This was exemplified in Mr. Henderson. He began to look upon the courses of the prevailing party and the Church of Scotland with a different eye from what he had done formerly when he was guided by a worldly spirit and by views of ambition. Their tendency he perceived to be injurious to the interests of practical religion. He, however, judged it proper to give the existing controversy a deliberate investigation, the result of which was that he found episcopacy to be equally unauthorized by the Word of God and inconsistent with the Reformed Constitution of the Church of Scotland. He did not long want an opportunity of publicly declaring his change of views and of appearing on the side of that cause which he had hitherto discountenanced. From the time that the prelatic government had first been obtruded upon the Church of Scotland, a plan had been laid to conform her worship also to the English model. After various preparatory steps, an assembly was suddenly indicted at Perth in the year 1618, in which, by the most undue influence, a number of superstitious innovations were authorized. Among those ministers who had the courage to oppose these innovations and who argued against them with great force of truth but without success, we find the name of Mr. Alexander Henderson of Lukers. It is remarkable that it was proposed in this assembly that he and his friend, Mr. William Scott of Cooper, should be translated to Edinburgh. This proposal, there is the best reason for supposing, was made with a view of soothing the inhabitants of that city, and of procuring a more ready submission to the other acts of that assembly without any serious intention of settling these able advocates for nonconformity in that station. Quote, "The bishops," says Calderwood, "meant no such thing in earnest." Unquote. But the proposal testifies the esteem in which Mr. Henderson was held, even at that early period, by the faithful part of the Church of Scotland, unto whom he had lately adjoined himself. In the month of August, 1619, Mr. Henderson and two other ministers were called before the Court of High Commission in St. Andrews, charged with composing and publishing a book entitled Perth Assembly, proving the nullity of that assembly, and with raising a contribution to defray the expense of printing the work. They appeared and answered for themselves with such wisdom that the bishops could gain no advantage against them, and were obliged to dismiss them with threatenings. Both before and after the ratification of the Acts of Perth Assembly by the Parliament in 1621, many honest ministers were greatly harassed on account of their nonconformity. But the aversion to the newly introduced ceremonies was so general, and the minority against whose will they were carried, both in Assembly and Parliament, so respectable, that it was judged impolitic and dangerous to enforce a rigid and universal compliance with them. A number of ministers who opposed and refused to practice them were overlooked and permitted to continue in their charges, particularly in the West Country and in Fife, where Mr. Henderson's parish lay. From this period until the year 1637, it does not appear that he suffered much, although he continued to be watched with a jealous eye and cramped in his exertions for promoting the cause of truth and holiness. One feels a desire to know how a person in Mr. Henderson's situation was employed during so long an interval of partial restraint. And even when the records from which information is drawn are in a great measure silent, we may, without transgressing far the limits of history, form conclusions from the character of the man and the appearance which he made when afterwards drawn into public notice. Secluded from the bustle of the world, he had an opportunity of conversing with his God and of being admitted to those heavenly enjoyments and attaining those religious experiences which are often, in a high degree, the privileges of Christians placed in such circumstances. The time which Mr. Henderson spent in his retirement, though obscure on the page of history, was not the least useful period of his life. Living sequestered in his parish and excluded from taking any share in the management of the ecclesiastical affairs of the nation, he had leisure to push his inquiries into the extensive field of theology and the history of the church, and laid up those stores of knowledge which he afterwards had an opportunity of displaying. The sedulous discharge of pastoral duties afforded him regular employment, and in the success with which this was attended, he enjoyed the purest gratification. Besides this, he met occasionally with his brethren of the same mind at fasts and communions, when by sermons and conferences they encouraged one another in adhering to the good old principles of the Church of Scotland, and joined in fervent supplications to God for the remedy of those evils under which they groaned. Mr. Livingston mentions Mr. Henderson as one of those godly and able ministers with whom he got acquainted in attending these solemn occasions between the year 1626 and 1630, the memory of whom, says he, is very precious and refreshing. At length, the time for delivering the Church of Scotland arrived. The Lord regarded the prayers and fasting of his servants, made their light to rise out of obscurity, and restored their captivity in an unexpected and surprising way. Those who had become enamored with the external form of the English Church judged, in concurrence with the court, that a fit season now offered for introducing its complete model into Scotland. Accordingly, in 1636, a book of ecclesiastical canons was sent down from England, and in the course of the same year a book of ordination. After some delay, the Anglo-Popish liturgy or service book, framed after the English model but with alterations, which according to the scheme then on foot of reconciling the Romish and English churches, approached nearer to the Popish ritual, made its appearance. Had Scotland tamely submitted to this yoke and allowed the threefold cord to be thrown over her, she might afterwards have sighed and struggled in vain for liberty. But the arbitrary manner in which these innovations were imposed, not less offensive than the matter of them, added to the dissatisfaction produced by former measures of the court and bishops, excited universal disgust and aroused a spirit of opposition, which was not allayed until not only the obnoxious acts were swept away, but the whole fabric of episcopacy, which during so many years they had labored to rear, was leveled with the dust. Sensible of gross mismanagements and galled with disappointment, the defenders of Scottish episcopacy have endeavored to throw the blame sometimes on the young bishops, sometimes upon the statesmen employed in the transaction. But it is evident that while their councils were in some things divided, they did all, young and old, churchmen and statesmen, urge forward with singular infatuation those measures which precipitated their fall. The tumult which was produced by the first reading of the liturgy in Edinburgh on the 23rd of July, 1637, is well known. Bishop Guthrie represents this disturbance as the result of a previous consultation in April, at which time, he says, Mr. Alexander Henderson came from the Brethren in Fife and Mr. David Dixon from those in the West, and in concert with Lord Balmerino and Sir Thomas Hope, engaged certain matrons to put the first affront upon the service book. The bishop was so well acquainted with this piece of secret history that he has given us the names of the women employed. It is rather unfavorable to the credibility of this story that it flatly contradicts the official accounts, not only of the town council of Edinburgh and of the Privy Council, but of His Majesty also, which declare that, after the most strict inquiry, it appeared that the tumult was begun by the meaner sort of people, without any instigation, concert, or interference of the better classes. But the bishop himself, in his eagerness to asperse Mr. Dixon, has mentioned a fact which enables us completely to disprove the charge, and which discredits his whole account. He says that Mr. Dixon, in going home by Stirling, gave out that his errand to Edinburgh was to accompany Mr. Robert Blair to a ship which was to carry him to Germany. Now, Mr. Blair's design of going to the continent was not before, but a considerable time after the tumult, being formed in the midst of the regular opposition which was made to the innovations, and at a time when there was little appearance of the petitioners obtaining a favorable answer to their demands. But although Mr. Henderson had no share in any private cabal or plot, he had from the first intimation of the projected changes expressed his disapprobation of them, and did not scruple, after their appearance, publicly to expose their dangerous tendency. While this irritated the ruling party, it endeared him to others. As early as March 1637, we find Mr. Rutherford thus writing to him, quote, "As for your case, my reverend and dearest brother, ye are the talking of the north and of the south, and looked to so as if ye were all crystal glass. Your motes and dust should, will, be proclaimed, and trumpets blown at your slips. But I know ye have laid help upon one that is mighty. Entrust not your comforts to men's airy and frothy applause, neither lay your downcastings on the tongues of salt-mockers and reproachers of godliness." Unquote. His early and public appearances were the occasion of his being singled out among the objects of persecution to deter others from imitating their example. The Archbishop of St. Andrews gave a charge to Mr. Henderson and other two ministers in his diocese to purchase each two copies of the liturgy for the use of their parishes within 15 days under the pain of rebellion. Mr. Henderson immediately came to Edinburgh, and on the 23rd of August presented a petition to the Privy Council for himself and his brethren, stating their objections and praying a suspension of the charge. To this petition, and others of a similar kind, providentially presented about the same time, the Council returned a favorable answer, and transmitted to London an account of the aversion of the country to conformity. This was an important step, as it directed all that were aggrieved to a regular mode of obtaining relief. And the Privy Council having, at this early stage, testified their aversion to enforce the novations, did afterwards, on different important occasions, befriend and promote the cause of the petitioners. From this time forward, Mr. Henderson took an active share in all the measures of the petitioners, and his prudence and diligence contributed not a little to bring them to a happy issue. They soon discovered his value and improved it by employing him in their most important and delicate transactions. Indeed, he was engaged with so little intermission in the public transactions which followed that the history of the remaining part of his life necessarily involves some account of these. Without, however, entering into a detail of public events which may be found in the general histories of the period, although often very inadequately and partially represented, it shall be the object of this memoir to select those incidents in which Mr. Henderson was more particularly concerned and which tend to throw light upon his character. As we are now to view him in a very different scene from the tranquil and retiring one in which he formerly acted, it may be agreeable to hear his own beautiful and serious reflections upon the ordinations of divine sovereignty in this matter, made when he was in London, in the midst of those great undertakings to which Providence had gradually conducted him. Quote, "When," says he, "from my sense of myself and of my own thoughts and ways, I begin to remember how men who love to live obscurely and in the shadow are brought forth to light, to the view and talking of the world, how men that love quietness are made to stir and to have a hand in public business, how men that love soliloquies and contemplations are brought upon debates and controversies, and generally how men are brought to act the things which they never determined, nor so much as dreamed of before. The words of the prophet Jeremiah come to my remembrance. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. Let no man think himself master of his own actions or ways. When thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkedst whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands. Another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. These reflections show that in the active part which he took in the troubles, he was neither goaded by resentment for the restraints to which he had been subjected, nor stimulated by that ambition which leads men to seek for fame in the embroilments of public affairs, a remark which the whole of his subsequent life serves to justify. The number of the petitioners against the innovations increased so rapidly that in a short time the body of the nation was embarked in the cause, and they found it necessary to divide themselves into four companies, consisting of the noblemen, the gentlemen of the shires, the burgesses, and the ministers, and to commit the prosecution of their petitions to a certain number of deputies or commissioners appointed by each of these, which was done with the approbation of the Privy Council. After having been amused for some time with promises, their meetings were suddenly prohibited by a proclamation from His Majesty under pain of rebellion. Alarmed by this procedure and convinced that they could not confide in the court, they saw the necessity of adopting some other method for strengthening their union. That to which they were directed was, both in a divine and human point of view, the most proper. They recollected that formerly, in a time of great danger, the nation of Scotland had entered into a solemn covenant, by which they bound themselves to continue in the true Protestant religion, and to defend and support one another in that cause against their common enemies. The several tables being assembled, the noblemen, having called Messrs. Henderson and Dixon to their assistance, agreed to renew this covenant, and approved of a draft for this purpose. This being sent to the other tables was unanimously adopted. It was substantially the same with the National Covenant, which had been sworn by all ranks and ratified by every authority in the kingdom during the preceding reign, but was adapted to the corruptions which had been introduced since that period and to the circumstances in which the covenanters were placed, in which respect it differed from what was called the King's Covenant, afterwards enjoined. On the 1st of March, 1638, the covenant was sworn with uplifted hands and subscribed in the Grey Friars Church by thousands, consisting of the nobility, gentry, burgesses, ministers of the gospel and commons, assembled from all parts of Scotland. And copies of it being circulated throughout the kingdom, it was everywhere sworn and subscribed with the greatest alacrity. Quote, "This memorable deed, of which it would be improper to forget the authors, was prepared by Alexander Henderson, the leader of the clergy, and Archibald Johnston, afterwards of Warriston, an advocate, in whom the suppliants chiefly confided, and revised by Balmerino, Loudon, and Rothes." Unquote. About this time, the city of Edinburgh fixed their eyes upon Mr. Henderson for one of their ministers. Among other articles of information sent up to the Scottish bishops then at London by their friends in Scotland was the following. Quote, "The Council of Edinburgh have made choice of Mr. Alexander Henderson to be helper to Mr. Andrew Ramsay and intend to admit him without advice or consent of the bishops." Unquote. It is probable that his own aversion to be translated, which he afterwards discovered to be very strong, and the desire of the petitioners not to throw any unnecessary obstacle in the way of the settlement, were the causes which hindered the motion from being carried into effect at this time. In the month of July, Mr. Henderson, together with Mr. Dixon, was sent by the Tables to the north to persuade the inhabitants to take the covenant, particularly those of Aberdeen, who, by the influence of their doctors of divinity and the Marquis of Huntly, had hitherto declined to join with their brethren in other parts of the nation. Upon their arrival at Aberdeen, the doctors presented to them 14 captious demands respecting the covenant, which they had drawn up with much care and art. Different papers passed between the doctors and the deputed ministers on this subject, which were published. Those of the latter were written by Mr. Henderson. The deputies, being otherwise engaged and seeing no prospect of removing the prejudices of men who had adopted principles which led them to comply with whatever the court should enjoin, desisted from the controversy and left it to be carried on by individuals through the press. Being refused access to the pulpits of Aberdeen, they preached to great crowds of people in the open air. Many were disposed to mock, but the only outrage which took place was committed by a student named Logie, a profligate youth, who threw stones at the commissioners while Mr. Henderson was preaching, and who shortly after was found guilty of the murder of a boy and executed. After preaching in various places and procuring the subscriptions of several hundreds in Aberdeen, besides those in different parts of the country, they returned to their constituents. The next public appearance which Mr. Henderson was called to make was in the celebrated assembly which met at Glasgow. The petitioners continuing firm and united, the court found it necessary to grant their demands by calling a general assembly and parliament to consider the grievances of which the nation complained. The first thing that engaged the attention of the assembly, which sat down on the 21st of November, 1638, was the choice of a moderator. Considering the critical state of affairs, the period which had elapsed since a general assembly had been held in Scotland, the important discussions expected and the multitude assembled to witness them, the filling of the station in a proper manner was of great consequence. It required a person of authority, resolution, and prudence, one who could act in a difficult situation in which he had not formerly been placed. Mr. Henderson had given evidence of his possessing these qualifications in a high degree, and he was unanimously called to the chair. Having solemnly constituted the assembly, he addressed the members in a neat and appropriate speech. Throughout the whole of that assembly, he justified the good opinion which his brethren entertained of him. To His Majesty's commissioner he behaved with the greatest respect, and at the same time with an independence and firmness which became the president of a free assembly. His behavior to the nobility and gentry who were members and to his brethren in the ministry were equally decorous. His prudence and ability were put to the test on two occasions, the premature dissolution of the assembly by the royal commissioner and the excommunication of the bishops. Of his conduct in these, it is proper to give some account. Although the king had called the assembly, it was not his design to allow them fairly to proceed to the discussion of ecclesiastical business and to examine and rectify abuses, but only to cause to be registered such concessions flowing from his own will and authority as he found it necessary in present circumstances to grant. The Marquis of Hamilton, his commissioner, had instructions not to consent formally to any part of their procedure, and at a proper time to oppose a nullity to the whole. On the other hand, the members considered themselves as a free assembly, and were resolved to claim and exercise that liberty and power which they possessed, agreeably to Presbyterian principles, and the laws of the land, ratifying the Presbyterian government and the freedom of its judicatories. The declinature of the bishops having been read, at the repeated request of the commissioner, the assembly were proceeding in course to vote themselves competent judges of the libels raised against them. Upon this, the commissioner interposed and declared that if they proceeded to this, He could continue with them no longer, and delivered His Majesty's concessions to be read and registered. After the clerk had read them, the moderator addressed His Grace in a grave and well-digested speech. He returned thanks in the name of the Assembly for His Majesty's goodness in calling the Assembly, and the willingness to remove the grievances complained of, which he had testified in the paper now read. He condescended upon the power which the Reformed churches allowed magistrates respecting ecclesiastical affairs, and declared that the Assembly were heartily disposed to give unto their king and his commissioner all that honor and obedience which was consistent with the duty they owed to the King of Kings. Quote, "Sir," answered the commissioner, "you have spoken as becometh a good Christian and a dutiful subject, and I am hopeful that you will conduct yourself with that deference you owe to your royal sovereign, all of whose commands will, I trust, be found agreeable to the commandments of God." Unquote. The moderator replied that being indicted by His Majesty and constituted according to the acts and practice of former times, they looked upon themselves as a free assembly, and he trusted that all things would be conducted agreeably to the law of God and reason, and hoped that their king, being such a lover of righteousness, would, upon a proper representation, cordially agree with them. Having said this, he asked the members again if he should put the question as to the competency of the assembly to judge the bishops. The commissioner urged that the question should be deferred. Quote, "Nay, with your grace's permission, that cannot be," said the moderator, "for it is fit to be only after the declinature hath been under consideration." Unquote. The commissioner repeated that in this case it behooved him to withdraw. Quote, "I wish the contrary from the bottom of my heart," replied Mr. Henderson, "and that your grace would continue to favor us with your presence without obstructing the work and freedom of the assembly." Unquote. After having in vain insisted on the moderator to conclude with prayer, the commissioner did in His Majesty's name dissolve the assembly, discharging them under the highest pains from continuing to sit longer. Upon the commissioners leaving the house, the moderator delivered an animating address to the assembly. He reminded them of the divine countenance which had hitherto been shown to them in the midst of their greatest difficulties. They had done all that was in their power to obtain the countenance of human authority, and now, when deprived of it, they ought not to be discouraged in maintaining the rights which they had received from Christ as a court constituted in His name. "We perceive," said he, "His Grace, my Lord Commissioner, to be zealous of His Royal Master's commands. Have not we as good reason to be zealous towards our Lord, and to maintain the liberties and privileges of His kingdom?" Immediately after this, upon the moderator's putting the question, the members did, first by uplifted hands, and then by a formal vote, declare their resolution to remain together until they finished the weighty business which urgently demanded their consideration. At the opening of the next session, Mr. Henderson again addressed the assembly and put them in mind of the propriety of their paying particular attention in the circumstances in which they were now placed to gravity, quietness, and order. Not, he said, that he assumed anything to himself, but he was bold to direct them in that wherein he knew he had the consent of their own minds. It is but justice to add that this advice was punctually complied with throughout the whole of that long assembly. The assembly, having finished the processes of the bishops, agreed, at the close of their 19th session, that the sentences passed against them should be publicly pronounced next day by the moderator, after a sermon to be preached by him suitable to the solemn occasion. It was in vain that he pleaded his fatigue, the multiplicity of affairs by which his attention was distracted, and the shortness of the advertisement with a view to preparation. No excuse was admitted. Accordingly, at the time appointed, he preached before a very large auditory, from Psalm 110, verse 1. "The Lord said unto my Lord, Sit thou at my right hand, until I make thine enemies thy footstool." After narrating the steps which the assembly had taken, and causing an abstract of the evidence against the bishops to be read for the satisfaction of the people, he, quote, "in a very dreadful and grave manner," unquote, says one who is present, pronounced the sentences of deposition and excommunication. The whole assembly being deeply affected and filled with mingled emotions of admiration, pity, and awe. On the day following, a petition from St. Andrews was presented to the assembly, supplicating that Mr. Henderson should be translated to that city. This was opposed by the commissioners from Edinburgh, who pleaded that he was already their minister-elect. Mr. Henderson himself was extremely averse to remove from his present charge and keenly opposed it in the assembly. He pleaded that he was too old a plant to take root in another soil, and that he might be more useful where he was than in a public station. If he was to be removed, his love of retirement inclined him rather to St. Andrews than Edinburgh. After a warm contest between the two places, it carried that he should be translated to Edinburgh. Upon this decision of the assembly, he submitted, having obtained a promise that he should be allowed to remove to a country charge if his health should require it, or when the infirmities of old age should overtake him. When the assembly had brought their business to a conclusion, Mr. Henderson addressed them in an able speech of considerable length, of which we can here only present an outline. He apologized for the imperfect manner in which he had discharged the duties of the situation in which they had placed him, and thanked them for rendering his task so easy by the manner in which they had conducted themselves. Exhorted them gratefully to remember the wonderful goodness of the Almighty, and not to overlook the instances of favor which they had received from their temporal sovereign. He adverted to the galling yoke from which they had been rescued, pointed out some of the visible marks of the finger of God in effecting this, and earnestly exhorted them to a discreet use and steady maintenance of the liberties which they had obtained. Quote, "We are like a man that has lain long in irons, who after they are off and he, redeemed, feels not his liberty for some time, but the smart of them makes him apprehend that they are on him still. So it is with us. We do not yet feel our liberty. Take heed of a second defection, and rather endure the greatest extremity than be entangled again with a yoke of bondage." Unquote. In conclusion, he inculcated upon them a favorable construction of His Majesty's opposition to them, expressed his high sense of the distinguished part which the nobles, barons, and burgesses had acted, of the harmony which had reigned among the ministers, and of the kind and hospitable treatment which the members of assembly had received from the city of Glasgow. After desiring some members to supply anything which he had omitted, he concluded with prayer, singing the 133rd Psalm, and pronouncing the apostolical benediction, upon which the assembly rose in triumph. Quote, "We have now cast down the walls of Jericho," said Mr. Henderson when the members were rising. "Let him that rebuildeth them beware of the curse of Hiel the Bethelite." Unquote. The distinguished place which Mr. Henderson occupied in this assembly, and the active part which he took in its proceedings, could not fail, notwithstanding the propriety and moderation of his conduct, to expose him to the resentment of the court and bishops. In the large declaration, drawn up by Dr. Balkenqual, and published in the king's name, he is called the prime and most rigid covenanter in the kingdom. Archbishop Laud, in a letter to the Marquess of Hamilton, says that the only thing in the full accounts sent him of the proceedings of the assembly, which required an answer, was, quote, "that Mr. Alexander Henderson, who went all this while for a quiet and calm-spirited man, hath shown himself a most violent and passionate man, and a moderator without moderation," unquote. nor was the primate at any loss to account for this transformation of the lamb into the lion. For he adds, quote, "Truly, my lord, never did I see any man of that humor," that is, the Presbyterian, "but he was deep-dyed in some violence or other, and it would have been a wonder to me if Henderson had held free." Unquote. Meek-eyed and merciful prelacy, thou hast ever inspired thy votaries with moderation. The proceedings of the High Commission and Star Chamber will continue to bear witness that their voice was never disgraced by rude passion, nor their hands stained with violence or blood. The censures of men disappointed in the mad project of subjugating a whole nation under tyranny and superstition will be regarded as praises by all good Christians and patriots. A short time after this, Laud and Balcancal were declared public incendiaries by the king and the parliaments of both kingdoms. While Mr. Henderson was honored by them and his conduct vindicated as laudable and patriotic. Whilst his countrymen were making preparations during the winter 1639 for defending themselves against the hostile invasion from England, Mr. Henderson's pen was employed in several publications in vindication of their proceedings. Among other papers, he drew up The Remonstrance of the Nobility, etc., with the Kingdom of Scotland, vindicating them and their proceedings from the crimes wherewith they are charged by the late proclamation in England, February 27, 1639. Which paper, after being revised by the deputies, was published and circulated in England, and was of great advantage to their cause in that country. He also drew up Instructions for Defensive Arms, intending to give information to all among themselves respecting the just and necessary grounds of the defensive war into which they were forced. As this was hastily composed and the subject was delicate, he declined making it public. But one Corbett, a deposed minister who fled to Ireland, carried a copy along with him and published it with an answer. As it contains a vindication of the conduct of the nation in that important affair, and of himself and the share which he took in it, a short view of its contents may not be improper here. The question he states, with great accuracy, to be whether or not the body of a nation, with the nobles, counselors, barons, and burgesses, owning all just subjection to the supreme magistrate, and only seeking the enjoyment of their religion and liberties, established and solemnly guaranteed to them, have a right to stand on their defense against a king who, at a distance from his people, and misled by the misinformation and malice of evil counselors, invades them at the head of a foreign force to overturn their laws and bring ruin upon themselves and their posterity. That they have such a right, and that it is their duty to use it, he argues from the absurdities of the doctrine of non-resistance, from the doctrine of Scripture and reason regarding the end of magistracy, the line of subordination in which prince and people are placed, the covenant bond of both king and people of God, the contract between the sovereign and his subjects, the law of self-preservation and defense in other cases, Scripture examples, the testimonies of the most judicious writers, and similar cases in other reformed countries. The king, being induced by the determined appearance of the Scots at Dunslaw, and the coldness which the English manifested in the cause to listen to overtures for a pacification, Mr. Henderson was appointed one of the commissioners on the part of his countrymen. He and Mr. Archibald Johnston declined going to the English camp with the rest of the commissioners on the first day of the treaty, but being informed that His Majesty took notice of their absence, they repaired to it on the following day. The king and his English counselors expressed their great esteem for Mr. Henderson, who, throughout the whole of the treaty, was particularly in his speeches to His Majesty, displayed wisdom, eloquence, and loyalty. Bishop Burnett has remarked that it was strange to see Mr. Henderson, who had acted so vigorously against the bishops for meddling with civil affairs, made a commissioner for this treaty, and sign a paper so purely civil as the pacification was. This is one of those reflections which appear plausible and acute at first view, but which a comparison of the two cases will discover to be groundless. Not to mention that the present was an extraordinary conjuncture, in which all that was dear to a people was at stake, and when it was proper that all their talents should be called forth and employed, it is evident that religion had been the principal cause of the quarrel, and that its interests were deeply concerned in the termination to which it might be brought. And although the articles of the pacification mentioned only the disbanding of the forces, yet it is well known that these proceeded upon the king's declaration, engaging that all matters ecclesiastical should be determined by the assemblies of the church, that general assembly should be called once a year, and that one should be convened in August to settle the present differences. When these things are considered, the presence of one of the ministry who could explain any point of difficulty and watch over the rights of the church may easily be vindicated. But this is toto coelo, different from bishops sitting as lords of parliament or filling the highest offices of state, which, besides other evils, render it impossible for them to attend to the important duties of their ecclesiastical function. Mr. Henderson was one of the 14 chief persons among the Covenanters who were sent for by the king to meet him at Berwick, after the Scottish army was disbanded. But an alarm having spread of a design against their life or liberty, they were stopped at the Watergate of Edinburgh, where they were setting out on their journey, by the populace, who took their horses from them and obliged them to return. Nor was it judged prudent that they should afterwards proceed, a measure which gave great offense to His Majesty. At the opening of the General Assembly, which met at Edinburgh, August 12, 1639, Mr. Henderson preached from Acts 4:23, and in the conclusion of his discourse addressed suitable exhortations to the Royal Commissioner, the Earl of Traquair, and to the members of the Assembly. Quote, "We beseech your grace," he said, "to see that Caesar have his own. But let not Caesar have what is due to God and belongs to him. God has exalted your grace to many high places within these few years, and more especially now. Be thankful and labor to exalt Christ's throne. Some are called like Haman, some like Mordecai. And I pray God these good parts the Lord has endued you withal, you may use aright, as the Israelites, when they came out of Egypt, did give all their silver and gold for the building of the tabernacle, and you, right honorable, worshipful, and reverend members of this assembly, go on in your zeal constantly. Surely it shall be a refreshment to you and your children, that you should have lived when the light of the gospel was almost extinguished, and now to see it quickened again. After all these troubles, with a holy moderation, go on, for zeal is a good servant, but an ill master. Like a ship that has a full sail and wants a rudder. We have need of Christian prudence, for ye know what ill speeches our adversaries have made upon us. Let it be seen to His Majesty that this presbyterial government can very well stand with a monarchical government. Hereby we shall gain His Majesty's favor, and God shall get the glory, to whom be praise for ever and ever. Amen." Unquote. The commissioner earnestly requested that the former moderator should be continued in the chair out of respect to Mr. Henderson's abilities, as he protested, but rather, as was suspected, to support His Majesty's pretensions to the right of nominating the person who should occupy that place and of continuing him in it at pleasure. But this was opposed by the members of the Assembly and by none more than Mr. Henderson himself, who urged that it favored the practice of constant moderator, which in former times had been employed as an introduction to prelacy. On the 31st of August, Mr. Henderson preached an excellent sermon at the opening of the Parliament from 1 Timothy 2, 1-3, in which he treated of the end, utility, and duties of magistracy. In the year 1640, he was placed at the head of the University of Edinburgh by the town council of that city. They had been accustomed to visit the college annually, which made the rector remiss in the discharge of his office. They now resolved, instead of these periodical visitations, to choose a rector annually and to ascertain more precisely the powers of his office by instructions framed for that end. Agreeably to this resolution, they, quote, chose Mr. Alexander Henderson, one of the ministers of Edinburgh, rector of the university, ordaining a silver mace to be borne before him on all solemnities, and appointing certain members of the town council, ministers of Edinburgh, and professors in college, his assessors. Unquote. They empowered him to superintend all matters connected with the conduct of the principal and professors, the education of youth, the revenues, etc., to admonish offenders, and in case of obstinacy, to make a report to the town council. In this office, which he appears to have enjoyed by re-election to his death, he exerted himself sedulously to promote the interests of that learned seminary. From the superintendence of this peaceful seat of literature, and from his pastoral functions, Mr. Henderson was again reluctantly called by a new embroilment of public affairs. The king, yielding to the importunate solicitations of the episcopal clergy, had refused, notwithstanding his promise at the late pacification, to ratify the conclusions of the assembly and parliament, suddenly prorogued the latter, denounced the Scots as rebels, and prepared again to invade the country. But the success of the Scottish army who entered England in August 1640 necessitated him a second time to accede to pacific proposals. And a treaty to this effect was begun at Ripon, which in a short time after this was transferred to London. Mr. Henderson was appointed one of the commissioners for this treaty. It was on this occasion that the foundation was laid of that conjunction in religion as well as civil amity between Scotland and England, which was afterwards solemnly ratified and sworn. And just and enlarged views of the state of public matters which produced this, and of the reasons upon which those who established it proceeded, are requisite in order to form a proper judgment of the public measures which were afterwards pursued by the friends of religion and liberty in the three kingdoms, as well as to vindicate the subject of this memoir for the part which he acted in them. But, sensible of the difficulty of conveying an adequate idea of the subject, within the limits to which he is confined, the memorialist enters not here upon this field. Suffice it to say that upon a retrospective view of the state of the Scottish Church, her friends perceived that she had been exposed to perpetual danger from the encroachments of her powerful neighbor. Her peace had been interrupted, and the spiritual government and worship which she had embraced and solemnly sworn to maintain had been repeatedly infringed and overturned to make way for the more pompous but superstitious form of the English Church. They perceived a concerted plan between the court and English bishops, persisted in and often renewed to obtrude the hierarchy and ceremonies upon them. To this they could easily trace the late innovations which had so much distracted the kingdom of Scotland. They had been denounced as rebels from all the pulpits of the hierarchical clergy in England, who had twice within 2 years instigated His Majesty to make war against Scotland, and had contributed so liberally to raise the armies destined for subduing that country, that it was called, even in England, the Bishop's War. On these grounds, the Scots saw little rational prospect of their being long allowed peaceably to enjoy their religious privileges, while the English hierarchy retained its power. At this time, too, multitudes in England who were sensible of the corruptions and groaned under the tyranny of their ecclesiastical government earnestly desired reformation and had given in petitions to the Supreme Court for the abolition of the hierarchy. And the Parliament, which was sitting at London during the time of the treaty, had with great zeal taken measures for the reformation both of government and worship. In these circumstances, the Scottish commissioners, according to instructions from their constituents, gave in a proposal for unity in religion and uniformity in church government as a special means for conserving of peace between the two kingdoms. At the same time, they delivered to the English commissioners a paper drawn up by Mr. Henderson, which stated very forcibly the grounds of this proposal and condescended upon a mode of carrying it into effect, which paper was transmitted to the English Parliament. To the above demand, a favorable answer was returned by the King and Parliament, signifying in general that they approved of the affection expressed by the Scots and their desire, and that, quote, as the Parliament had taken into consideration the reformation of church government, so they will proceed therein in due time, unquote. Which answer was ratified as one of the articles of the treaty. During the whole time that he was in London attending on the treaty, which was protracted through 9 months, Mr. Henderson was laboriously employed. Besides taking his turn with his brethren, who attended as chaplains to the Scottish commissioners in the church of St. Antheline's, which was assigned unto them as a place of public worship, he and they were often employed in preaching for the London ministers, both on Sabbath and on other days. He prepared several tracts for the press, which were published without his name. The polishing of the most important papers of the Scottish commissioners was committed to him before they were given into the commissioners and Parliament of England. Those which respected religion were of his composition. During his stay in London, Mr. Henderson had a private conference with the King, the special object of which was to procure assistance to the university in Scotland from the rents formerly appropriated to the bishops. He was graciously received and got reason to expect that his request would be complied with. Mr. Henderson returned to Edinburgh about the end of July 1641. The General Assembly had met at St. Andrews some days before, but as the Parliament, who were sitting in Edinburgh, had sent to request them to translate themselves to that place, for the convenience of those who were members of both, and as they wished that Mr. Henderson, who had not then returned from London, should act as moderator of this meeting, the members agreed that they should meet at Edinburgh on the 27th of July, and that the former moderator should preside until that time. Mr. Henderson had been elected a member of this assembly, but as it was uncertain if he could be present, his constituents had elected Mr. Fairfool to supply his place in case of his absence, and he had taken his seat at St. Andrews. Upon Mr. Henderson's arrival, Mr. Fairfool proposed to give place to him. This was keenly opposed by Mr. Calderwood, who insisted that his commission could not now be received, in which he was seconded by Mr. Henderson himself. But the Assembly sustained his commission, and although he deprecated the burden of moderating, this also was by a plurality of votes laid upon him. Mr. Calderwood continued to insist upon the great irregularity of translating the Assembly without a permanent moderator, and of choosing one to his seat who had no commission. But although in the judgment of the greater part of the members he spoke unreasonably and peevishly, Mr. Henderson treated him with great respect and patience. Instead of resenting his opposition as personal, he, previous to the dissolution of this assembly, publicly expressed his regret that Mr. Calderwood, who had deserved so well of this church, had been so long neglected, and procured a recommendation of him by the assembly, in consequence of which he was soon afterwards admitted to the church at Pencaitland. the chief business which engaged the attention of the assembly at this meeting, and on account of which Mr. Henderson's abilities and the moderation were desired, was the affair of private meetings, the discussion of which threatened to raise a dissension among the ministers. Some persons who were tainted with Brownistical and independent notions had insinuated themselves into those private societies for religious exercises which had been kept by serious persons, both in Scotland and Ireland, during the tyranny of the bishops, and had introduced some of their peculiarities into them. A number of the ministers who had witnessed the extravagancies of the separatists and were afraid that division and errors might thus creep into the church were desirous to restrain these meetings. Others, among whom were those ministers who had seen the benefit of private societies in the west of Scotland and in Ireland, suspected that some designed to condemn all private meetings for Christian edification. In the assembly held in Aberdeen the preceding year, the affair had been discussed, not without considerable heat. Mr. Henderson, sensible of abuses in these societies, had repeatedly expressed his dissatisfaction with them, on which account he was at first misunderstood by some of his brethren and met with disrespectful usage from certain individuals who were inclined to, quote, the discipline of New England, unquote, as independency was then termed. But the whole of his conduct showed that he was desirous only of correcting the perversions of these meetings. In the year 1639, he published a warm exhortation to the practice of the duties of family religion, which he considered as one remedy for such abuses. He afterwards drew up a paper of caveats as to the use of such meetings, which gave general satisfaction to his brethren on both sides of the question. This was proposed to the assembly at Aberdeen, at which he was not present, but in consequence of the heat which prevailed there, it was set aside. The matter was revived again in this assembly, 1641, and the debate, which was conducted harmoniously, issued in the enactment of an overture drawn up by Mr. Henderson in conformity with his general sentiments formerly expressed, and which may be seen in the printed acts of the assembly under the title of Acts Against Impiety and Schism. This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit westportexperiment.com for more audio resources, and where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things Reformed.